We're at the University of Sarajevo, and what's interesting, if you look up here, you're going to see on top of the university the what resembles the Kaaba of Mecca. That's the prayer facility. Can you see that? All the way up on top, right there. And then you got another one, you can't see, it's right up there, but we're a little bit too close. And that wasn't by coincidence, they did that to resemble the Kaaba in Mecca. So we're here at the University in Sarajevo. And we're meeting up with an American professor who accepted Islam. Let's hear his story. So we're here waiting to meet the professor here. Assalamu alaikum. Are you a professor?
Yes, I am.
Professor what?
Kaminsky.
Kaminsky?
Yes.
From Chicago?
Yes.
We found them. How are you doing?
Good. How are you all? Good to all see right. You.
Chicagoan. So you're originally from Chicago?
Down south suburbs, northwest Indiana. So I'm 20 minutes south of Chicago.
Crown Point, Maryville.
Yeah, Sherrillville. I'm literally like, yes, wow, you know the area.
I know the area.
Like, I'm right next to Maryville. Very cool.
So from Chicago to Indiana to Bosnia. Huh? So we look forward to talking with
I'm
you.
I'm excited. Too.
How'd you end up in Bosnia?
I needed a job. I wanted to work in a Muslim majority country, so this sort of was a perfect opportunity, and I've been here now for starting my fourth year.
And not only that, and then you actually accepted Islam.
Yes, I did about 10 years ago.
10 years ago, mashallah. We're going to have a lot to talk about.
What
do you teach here at the university?
I'm a political scientist who focuses on political theory, political philosophy, and Islamic political thought. Yeah. So I'm interested in these topics, the intersection of Western and Islamic thought, the Muslim world and the West. For me, it's a very important topic.
All right, we got the professor coming up on the Dean Show. Don't go anywhere.
Meet the brother also from Pennsylvania.
Where are you from?
I'm from Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. What's your name?
Jared Bell.
How you doing, Jared?
Good. How about yourself?
All right. Good. Thank God. How'd you end up in Bosnia?
I was doing research here and I ended up getting a job here in Bosnia.
Kakosi.
Dobro.
Dobro. All right. We meet all sorts of interesting people. I told you we're going to be bringing so many different faces. So what's your experience been? How long have you been here?
I've been here for a year. Before I did research here about a year ago.
How's the experience been?
Great. Great. People are really friendly here. Sometimes the bureaucracy is a little bit difficult, but otherwise it's great. People are very friendly, very helpful, and I love it.
What do you think, back at the Dean Show, what we do, we try to dispel many of the myths that revolve around Islam and Muslims, but you're living in a predominantly, Muslim majority country.
Sure.
Do you feel threatened at all?
Of course not.
Do you feel like there's a bunch of terrorists around you?
No, of course not. Most of my friends are Bosniaks, of course not. Yeah. Yeah, so no problem. Yeah, I love it.
We try to get people, most people who travel, they make the human connection.
Of course,
You know, people who are stuck maybe in some Mississippi, Alabama, some,
of course,
some rural area.
Yeah.
You know, what advice do you have for them? Maybe they turn it on and stuff. And
I think some of the key advice, I think, is even before I'm not a Muslim, by the way, but I used to attend the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh, and I would meet some of my friends, and it was a good eye-opener to Islam and what the religion was really about and what Muslims were really about. And actually, some of the friends I had from the masjid were some of the most wonderful people I've ever met in my life. So I think people really have to open up and educate themselves and kind of, meet with their neighbor and get to know them. And I think for such a diverse country like the United States, there's so many opportunities to actually experience other cultures, and people miss out on that, unfortunately.
Beautiful advice. Make the human connection.
Sure, definitely.
We're here in Bosnia.
Keep Thank you. In.
So we're with Professor Joseph, and we found him out of all places in Bosnia, Sarajevo. Professor, take us through a little bit of your journey in the beginning before you were Muslim, and how you took that turn that you started to really contemplate on the purpose of life, and because that's where you got to be. You got to be wondering, why am I created? Why am I here? Take us to those beginnings.
My beginnings are sort of interesting. I grew up in Indiana, went to college at Rutgers University, which is New Jersey, where I had my first exposure to Islam, and I knew nothing about it. And I was actually in New Jersey when 9/11 happened, right? It was a very traumatic experience on many levels, but at no point did I really ever connect terrorism to Islam. I just saw some crazy bad people blowing stuff up. So this connection never happened. So this was like, you know, Islam was never an issue. And I never thought about it. I was always believed in God. And I always believed in one God. But I didn't really have a religion to fall on. I grew up Roman Catholic, but I could never really accept many of the doctrines that are foundational to Catholic theology. So I would say I was agnostic until I was in my mid-20s. And while I was in graduate school, I was given the opportunity to teach for 1 year at Brooklyn College. And Brooklyn College is a fascinating place because it's a very, very unique student body, which I would say is about a third Jewish, about a third Muslim, and the rest Christians. So it's very different than most places in the United States. And one of the first things I remember when I was teaching, because I was like 24 at the time, so many of my students were almost my age, was, I'll be very honest, I was very impressed with the manners, with the adab of the brothers I met at Brooklyn College, many of whom I'm still very close with today. Believe it or not, one of the first people I actually encountered at Brooklyn College was Muhammad El-Shinawi, who you're probably familiar with now. He's quite popular. He's got a very popular media presence. And so I actually met a lot of really very well-mannered brothers. And this was the first thing that drew me into it, was meeting these people who didn't use bad language, who didn't talk about girls, didn't talk about getting drunk, shook hands, introduced themselves with the Salaam Alaikum, which I didn't know what it meant. So this is like my first exposure to Islam, was this the adab of the people. And as I continued my venture in New York, I just seemed to run into Muslims. It was like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had a plan for me to meet these people. And finally I realized that I wanted to understand this religion better. I didn't get it. I just knew that it was something different. So I finally purchased a copy of the Quran, the Pigthall translation actually, which I have somewhere here still. I read this translation, and it was really it changed everything. It changed my entire trajectory of life, honestly. So it was the people who I met that first got me interested, and then the book had me sold. It really answered all of the questions that I had prior to becoming a Muslim. It addressed all the questions that Christianity seemed to leave open. And I remember looking in the mirror, and I felt something I've never felt before, and I can't even say I've ever felt since. This sinking feeling in my stomach. I felt like I was on a roller coaster. I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm a Muslim. I started crying. And it was a very powerful experience that I can't really put words into. So that was my initial exposure to Islam. And what makes it really interesting is I wanted to learn more about it. So I remember going for the first time to make Salat in a mosque. So I went to an area, I lived in eastern Brooklyn, and I went to an area that was mostly Pakistani, and I was the only like white guy in there. Everyone else was older Pakistani men with henna beards and everything. I didn't really fit in. I knew nothing about the Salat, nothing. And I remember I walked in there and everyone looked at me, but they were very welcoming and very, a little bit, you know, surprised to see a big white guy walking in there, but they were very helpful. So I walk into the mosque not knowing anything. So I walk in with my shoes on. And they say, no, take your shoes off, take your shoes off. And then they hand me the lota, right? The thing to do wudu with. I didn't know what it was. All I could remember from my Catholic days was they give you this thing of wine to drink for the Catholic communion. So I thought that's what I was supposed to do. So I took it to my mouth to drink it. And they're like, no, don't do that. And then they explained how to properly do wudu. And I made salat with these men who I'd never met before. And when the khutbah was over, because it was the Jummah I went to, all the men came around me and hugged me. And the imam put his hand on my shoulder and made some dua that I didn't understand. And once again, I felt this powerful feeling, like I felt welcomed. I felt these people really loved me. It was something that you don't experience in other cultures. It was a genuine sense of warmth, a genuine sense of brotherly love. And that was really it. And after that, my entire research interest changed. I became more interested in Eastern political thought, Eastern philosophy, Islamic thought more generally. And this was really the beginning of my path to where I am today.
Now, some people might see the hat and think that you come from Afghani, or what's the connection? Yes. Can you explain for someone?
Yeah, this is an Afghani pakul that I actually got while I was living in New York about, I would say, 8 to 10 years ago. And for me, I've always been inspired by the Afghan people's resilience. It's a very difficult place to live. It's a very difficult times they face on many different fronts. And I don't know, I felt like when I first embraced Islam, I was always spent most of my time around people from Pakistan and people of that background, Afghanistan. So I didn't really get to know Turkish people or Arabs really until I was a little bit later in my development. So my initial introduction to Islam was from mostly Pakistanis. And this is sort of a Pakistani common hat as well. And I just like it. I like the way it feels. It reminds me I'm a Muslim. And it really sort of prevents me from doing things I shouldn't. I think of the hat. I think of I'm representing Islam and I need to manage myself, guard against temptation and fitna.
Tell us, Professor, you obviously are a person, an intellectual, someone who's thoroughly did their research, but when you hear some of these common cliches that people throw around, that Islam oppresses women, some people might be tuning in saying, how can he join a religion that promotes terrorism? And you know, many of the other misconceptions people have. How do you start off a conversation? Because sometimes you got to move these things out of the way before you can get, you know, to the crust of the matter.
One of the bits of advice I will give to people who are in this situation: first, you have to understand who is asking you the question. What is their intent? If they genuinely are questioning things and they're interested, if their heart is open, if their mind is really wanting to learn about Islam, if they're actually interested in having a real, genuine discussion, then I think you should engage these topics. But you need to be aware, some people just want to troll you. They want to harass you. And in these situations, I recommend to brothers and sisters, just understand that this person is just looking to cause trouble, and I don't want to talk about it, please. And just get out of the situation, because there's no point in debating with someone who already has their mind up. But most people, I believe, honestly, are somewhat open. And the way I address these questions is letting them know that there are, in fact, many different misapplications, misunderstandings, and misinterpretations of Islam by all levels of society, not just common lay people, but even scholars who sometimes issue very questionable fatwas, who do things that seem to be contradictory to the basic principles of Islam. And I recommend people to read the text themselves, to experience the religion themselves, and to spend time around Muslims and talk to people that have knowledge. Talk to people with good hearts and good spirits, and good souls. And I think this is the best way to go about doing this.
How was it now you accept Islam? Tell us that moment you took the Shahada.
Yes.
Define what that means and what happens from there. You talked about the experience of love. But then how about, was there any backlash from your family?
Very difficult experience for the convert, especially from a middle-class white Christian family, is dealing with family and friends. When I made my Shahada at Masjid al-Farouk in Brooklyn, it was a very powerful experience, but I knew it was going to change a lot of things, not just my inner soul, but my external surroundings and my relationships. And my parents, it was a very difficult transition for them. We had many fights for many years. But they finally recognized after a few years, it took years, that I wasn't one of the bad guys. I was somebody who truly embraced this religion for the reasons that were related to what the religion is all about. And over time, witnessing my change in behavior, the change in my actions, they started to tolerate and appreciate that I had become a better person. To this day, they still don't fully understand or accept Islam. And for many of you, your family and friends will never. Thankfully, in my case, very few of my friends ever had a problem. I didn't have to deal with that with friends. But with family members, it was a challenge, and it still is. But that's okay, because toleration is something that, you know, is important. And we're taught that we have to respect our parents, even if it's difficult. And it's a fitna for us. We have to stay connected to our families, even if they don't really like our religion. But as time went on, I can honestly say my relationship with my family has improved, and things are much, much better now than they were about 10 years ago, for sure.
I don't know how it is here in the university, but usually when you come to the university in the States, maybe you take a philosophy class,
yes,
you know, and usually the agenda is pushing God out of the equation. Mm-hmm. So you have a rise of people following the professors, some even blindly, and it becomes a religion of itself, and people are kind of like pushing God out of the picture. How do you usually, you know, spark up a conversation with someone who, because you said you were agnostic, as borderline, mm-hmm, almost atheist? What do you like to tell an individual like this when you're, you know, trying to talk with them?
When I'm engaging with my students on these topics, I always try to, like, juxtapose, you know, the Western arguments with the Islamic arguments. My job isn't to be a propagandist. I'm not here to indoctrinate my students with any worldview. Now, with that being said, you know, many philosophers argue that it's impossible to escape our subjective situation. Philosopher Thomas Nagel talks about the view from nowhere is impossible because we are all situated somewhere. But I think it's our job as faculty to try to separate our personal feelings as best we can, but it doesn't mean we can't use the logical, reasonable arguments that our religion provides us to make points and make cases. So very often when I do philosophy or when I do political science, I will reference Islamic texts, I will reference Quran, I will reference scholars of Islam, and I'll ask students to compare these ideas to some of the Western ideas. And as you said, in many ways, science itself has become a religion. And this is fascinating because this is an idea that even secular Western scholars in the 1930s and 40s, the critical theorists of Frankfurt School, they got involved with this idea of science becoming its own religion, for that matter. So when you try to approach these topics from a multidimensional perspective, I think you have a better chance of reaching out to everybody. So if I'm just using Islamic sources to prove my point, I'm going to alienate half a class. But if I'm just using secular sources, I'm going to alienate the other half. So you need to try to find a way to balance and get everybody involved in a discussion and conversation. And it's a difficult thing to do, but I think the longer you teach, the more experience you have in the classroom, the more you're able to handle this.
Now, your family was from a Christian background?
Yes, Roman Catholic.
Roman Catholic. If someone asks you now, are people kind of like you abandoned Jesus? You know, what is your view on Jesus now as a Muslim?
I think I have a much better, more realistic, proper understanding of Jesus, peace and blessings be upon him, now than I did when I was a Christian. Like I said, I could never understand the notion of the Trinity. This was something that even as a child I thought was silly. How can God be Jesus and the Holy Spirit at the same time? This just didn't make sense to me. How could God allow himself to be killed and then rise again? This just seemed so, just made no sense. And all the explanations offered to me just were not satisfactory. And quite honestly, I think now as a Muslim, the story of Jesus Christ, peace and blessing be upon him, makes a significant amount more sense. When you take Jesus and recognize him as a prophet, rather than as a divine figure, rather than as a semi-god or a god, it makes more sense. And you start to understand the real message and the teachings of Jesus better. And I think that, for me, the best thing I can say to young Muslims is continue to learn about Jesus Christ through Islamic sources. Because in my opinion, Christian sources can't be relied upon as much on this. As we know, Christian texts have been changed and translated and retranslated. I really think that young Muslims should look for Islamic sources for guidance about our prophet Jesus, because we have to remember that Jesus is our prophet as well.
You have this concept, the theology. Many people, they attack Islam on some of the things that might need some further clarification. But the one thing you really don't ever have a problem with is the belief system that worship the creator, not the creation. That just goes with the innate disposition that we are created with, right? Jesus did it, Moses did it, Abraham. And God, out of his love, he sent these messengers, you know, to guide humanity. But people, Prophet Muhammad, who is he? What from his teachings or from his life, what can you share with people who, you know, they don't know much, and the things they might know are things that are just false propaganda?
I think that, once again, it comes down to knowledge, and it comes down to finding good sources to read. And there are so many books today, some very, very negative books about the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, by non-Islamic scholars. I think a young Muslim needs to find somebody that they can trust. They need to find a group of people they can trust who can guide them to the right texts. Thankfully, alhamdulillah, my brothers at Brooklyn College were able to point me towards proper sources and proper guidance. And for people, I say, that don't understand the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, they need to understand how amazing of a man he actually was. When you consider the situation he was born into, horrible, horrible situation. I mean, was an orphan. He had to deal with idolaters, very powerful people in Mecca. He was able to overcome seemingly insurmountable odds and be victorious. And this is something, a lesson in perseverance, a lesson in having personal strength that I think anybody of any religious background can grasp and understand. Looking at the life of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, looking at his example and not being blindfolded by propaganda and misconceptions. And it's very dangerous because these people are very powerful. These Islamophobic actors have enormous amount of funding, and it's very important to be aware of these tactics. And this is why it's important to have steadfastness and to find people who you can trust, who can help you to properly evaluate sources, not just secular, but even religious sources, because too, some religious scholars are not necessarily as trustworthy as they should be.
What are your comments? What do you guys hear in this part of the world, you know, nowadays back home? As soon as there's, you know, some lunatic, some deranged, you know, nutcase, he does something, right? And somehow maybe he passed by a Muslim, maybe he had lunch with a Muslim, maybe he's, you know, a Muslim, but he's at the nightclub, he's drinking, he's doing everything opposite of Islam. Yeah. They love to stigmatize Islam and bring it in the equation. But just recently, I don't know if you're up with the news, it was the deadliest yes. mass murder that just happened, where close to, I think, 60 people were yes. killed, almost 500 injured. And the guy didn't yell Allahu Akbar, God is great, so it's not terrorists. They're looking at his mm-hmm. you know, mental state. Is this an obvious double standard that people are seeing here in hypocrisy? What are your comments on this?
Oh, I think for sure there's a major double standard here. I think that clearly when a Muslim does anything, it's terrorism, even if it is not. And when a, you know, quite honestly, a white male, not Muslim, does the same thing, it's framed very differently in the media. But I have a very important message regarding this. When using the term terrorism, it has to be understood as proper political science context. This is very important, because when we start throwing around terrorists, and this goes for Muslims too, claiming that, oh, this guy's committed an act of terrorism, we have to understand the parameters of terrorism as understood by most within UN definitions, which include an effort to instill fear in a civilian population through violence to get a political end accomplished. This is very important. If somebody commits mass murder and it does not have a political end, if it's just a crazy lunatic, literally who's crazy, that is not terrorism. And we need to remember this, because it protects ourselves. Because if the definition of terrorism gets to start being used for any single act of violence, it will ultimately be used against Muslims. Muslims need to make it clear that terrorism cannot just be used to describe any old act of violence. It really has to fit within these parameters of having a specific political end, seeking to change and alter policy. This is something that has to be considered. Otherwise, the term will, alter, as I said, it will be used inappropriately and will stigmatize communities.
You've been here in Bosnia for over how long now?
This is starting my fourth year.
Fourth year. Many people back home, it's kind of been a forgotten history. The greatest genocide that happened after World War II. Can you kind of fill in people who have no idea on what happened, just in brief, you know, summary of bringing people up to speed in this beautiful, wonderful country?
Shortly after the dissolution of, well, actually, so all story goes back to the early 1980s when Marshal Tito passed away. There was a period of instability as communism was on his deathbed. And then when the country started to finally break apart, people sort of immediately embraced their sectarian religious identities in a way that, in my opinion, wasn't necessarily authentic. I think this was more about nationalism, with religion as being used as an excuse. And indeed, the majority of the power were in the hands of the Serbians, who controlled the weapons, who were based out of Belgrade, the former capital of Yugoslavia. And when the dissolution happened, the Bosniak Muslims were in a very bad position. They had limited control of land, and they had limited control of weapons. And if you look at the geography of Sarajevo itself, it's situated between two mountains. And the Serbs, with their much superior military force and power and numbers, were able to literally bombard the city for three consecutive years. And through truly a miracle, the Bosniaks were able to survive, and with limited help from the West, were managed to hold this off long enough until an agreement could be reached. But some of the atrocities that happen in this country are absolutely incomprehensible. And we have many faculty here at this university who have family members who were killed in this war, and many people today who are still scarred, many people who even fought on the Bosnian side are at this university at different levels of the administration. So it's a very, very interesting place. For most Americans, we never experienced anything remotely in the universe of what many of these people have experienced. However, this country, I think, is trying to move on. There's still a lot of political instability. There's still a lot of sectarian differences between the different constituent groups. The political system here needs to be rethought, for sure. But at the same time, I do see progress. There has been a lot of investment from Arabs and from people from the Gulf states to help build some of these areas, which has brought tension itself as well, a new cultural tradition coming here. You have to understand, most of the Bosniaks are Hanif, Ottoman historian, and some Gulf state Arab Hanbali types. It's a little bit of a clash, but people are, I think most Bosnians are happy to see some level of investment, and at least religious Bosnians, I think, see the importance of brotherhood and connecting to the other Muslim majority countries.
Before we wrap up, some closing advice for those struggling.
Yes.
You know, now they are relating to you, former Catholic, then agnostic, you couldn't deal with the Trinity, trying to figure out the purpose of life. so many different, you know, misconceptions about Islam. They're turning into the Dean Show. What advice do you give them?
My advice is life is not short, it is long. And we ultimately don't know what Allah's plan is for us, right? A lot of my students ask this question about, do we have fate or do we have free will? And it gets very complicated from an Islamic perspective, as you know. But I always tell them this, regardless of what God's ultimate plan for us is, we have an obligation to do the best we can, to be the best people we can. Only God knows what actually that plan is. But we are responsible for doing our part to make this world a better place and to spreading Islam in a peaceful, intellectual manner, not through dogmatism, not through empty slogans, but through legitimate dialogue and through textual-based knowledge based on authentic primary Islamic sources. This is the issue, and I ask all of you people who are struggling with families and friends who are dealing with your conversion, remain steadfast, remain strong. Remember, you will be rewarded for this. This is a fitna, this is a part of the challenge we face, and generations before you suffered even more greatly than you could ever imagine. So I say that it's a difficult challenge, but it's a wonderful challenge. You have been blessed. You've been given the opportunity to experience a religion that not everyone's heart is open to. We all know that from Surah Al-Baqarah in the very beginning, where some people's hearts are simply closed, their minds are sealed. But you were blessed to have the opportunity to accept and embrace this beautiful religion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Joseph, thank you for being
with us. It's truly an honor.
Here on the Dean Show.
I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And thank you guys for tuning in. More from Bosnia. Assalamu alaikum.